So when you hear the phrase no internet, your brain probably goes straight to, a blinking red light on your router.
Right, or like the spinning wheel of doom right before a really important virtual meeting.
Yeah, exactly. It's this very localized, very modern panic,
Oh, absolutely.
a temporary disruption of comfort that, for most of us anyway, feels like the absolute end of the world for, well, about 20 minutes.
I mean, it is the ultimate first world inconvenience. And today's mission for our deep dive really takes that exact phrase, that highly specific modern anxiety, and it weaponizes it to show us something completely different.
Yeah, it really does.
We were looking at this incredibly stunning watercolor painting by the artist Jairo Duke, and it is simply titled Sin Internet So, No Internet.
And the journey this piece of art took before it even reached us is, well, it's fascinating in itself
It really is.
because it completely highlights that exact digital privilege we were just talking about. So the reference image that Duke used was actually sourced from the web. It was cataloged in Whittier, California, back in October of 2022. But then it gets translated into a physical 15 by 11 inch watercolor painting. And if you fast forward a year to October 2023, that physical piece is suddenly hanging in an exhibition halfway across the world.
Right, at the Nicoletta Gallery in Berlin.
Exactly.
And, that physical leap from California to a gallery wall in Germany, that was facilitated by the art boxing platform.
Which is such a cool concept, by the way.
It's amazing to
Yeah.
understand just how wild that trajectory is. I mean, think of art boxing as this massive global matchmaking service. It bridges the digital and physical art worlds.
Right.
So it takes these digital portfolios and it coordinates physical exhibitions globally. You end up bypassing a lot of the traditional gate-kept gallery scouting.
So you have an image that is basically pulled from the digital ether, painted into physical reality, and then distributed through an international digital network.
Exactly. The irony is just baked right into the medium.
It really is. So I want you, listening to this, to put yourself in the shoes of someone standing in that Berlin gallery. You're in this wealthy, ultra-connected European cultural center, and you walk up to a painting called Sin Internet.
Right, you have immediate expectations.
Exactly. You are absolutely bracing yourself for this slick, modern commentary on digital addiction.
Like a moody portrait of teenagers staring blankly at glowing smartphones in a cafe or something.
Yeah, exactly that. But instead, you are confronted with a palafito.
Which is quite the shock. A deeply precarious, rustic wooden stilt house built directly over a massive body of water.
And we should clarify specifically, this captures a scene from the Cienaga Grande del Magdalena in Colombia.
Yeah, and for those trying to picture it, this isn't some quaint little pond.
No, not at all.
The Cienaga is a massive, incredibly complex coastal lagoon. It is a fully amphibious environment where the water dictates, well, literally every single aspect of human life.
Okay, let's unpack this. Our goal today is to look at how this one single watercolor challenges our absolute definitions of what a city is,
Right.
what urban development actually means, and what it truly fundamentally means to be disconnected.
And to do that, I think we first have to look at the most striking action happening in the painting.
Yeah, which surprisingly is not happening down by the water.
No, it's
It's
not.
happening at the very top of the frame.
Yeah, the real visual surprise of the piece is up on the roof. So balancing on this slanted, highly dangerous-looking zinc roof, you have children flying a kite.
And as a viewer, I mean, your first instinct is to smile.
Of course.
You see the kite catching the wind. You see this playfulness, this pure, innocent joy of kids just, finding a way to play. It feels very light.
It does. But then your eyes sort of travel down the composition, and that initial smile fades pretty quickly.
Yeah, it hits you.
You realize the context of their joy. They are up on the roof because below them is just a sprawling expanse of water. There is absolutely zero solid ground.
The earth has literally been denied to them.
Exactly.
Well, let me play devil's advocate for a second here, because the artist explicitly categorized this piece in his notes as an urban painting.
He did.
And, I grew up in a pretty traditional suburban environment. When I think of kids playing, I think of neighborhood parks or, I don't know, maybe scraping a knee on a concrete driveway.
Right, a patch of grass at least.
Yeah, exactly. So when we look at kids forced to play on a slippery metal roof because they literally have no ground to stand on, if we call that a public plaza or some kind of urban innovation, aren't we just romanticizing extreme poverty?
That is a great question.
Like, aren't we letting society off the hook by saying, oh, look how resilient they are?
I mean, that is the exact trap that this painting brilliantly navigates. Because a cynical artwork might just romanticize the struggle, right?
Yeah.
While a purely political one would probably just strip the subjects of all their agency and basically pity them. But Duke does neither of those things. By classifying this as an urban painting, the artist is actively decolonizing the concept of urbanism.
Okay, let's break down that phrase for our listeners, because decolonizing urbanism, that can sound like some pretty dense academic jargon.
Fair point, yeah.
What does it actually mean practically when we look at this stilt house?
Practically, it means we have to stop judging human settlements exclusively by the standards of wealthy Western metropolises.
Okay.
We are so conditioned to believe that a city, you know, requires asphalt and organized grids and traffic lights and municipal zoning.
Right, the concrete jungle.
Exactly. So decolonizing that concept means stripping away those structural assumptions and asking, what is the fundamental purpose of a city?
Let's say it's human connection. You know, a place where people gather, organize, and just survive together.
Precisely. And in this amphibious settlement, those fragile wooden walkways connecting the still houses, they serve the exact same social function as a paved avenue in Manhattan.
Wow, yeah.
That dangerous zinc roof. That functions as the neighborhood patio or the public square.
It forces us to realize that the architecture of community isn't defined by concrete.
No, not at all. Here, social connectivity is held together by wood, custom, and just pure necessity. It is organized survival in a highly hostile environment.
Organized survival. I love that phrasing. But visually translating something as heavy as organized survival without the painting feeling like a depressing political pamphlet, that's a massive challenge.
Oh, an incredible challenge. And this is really where Duke's deliberate technical choices carry so much of the narrative weight. The medium basically becomes the message.
Now, we promise not to get bogged down in technical specifications, but the foundation of this piece is pretty essential.
It really is.
So Duke used cold-pressed 300-gram Arches paper and professional Daniel Smith watercolor pigments.
Yeah.
But I think the key word there is cold-pressed.
Yes, cold-pressed is vital here.
If you've ever run your bare hand over an old, sun-beaten wooden dock, you know that rough, splintery feeling?
Right.
That is exactly what the surface of this paper does to the paint.
Exactly, because cold-pressed paper has this distinct physical roughness to it. It's full of these tiny microscopic peaks and valleys.
Uh-huh.
So when you apply watercolor, the pigment pools in those little divots. It doesn't blend into a perfectly smooth, like, digital-looking gradient.
Right. It creates this very granular, almost fractured texture.
Yeah, and Duke really leans into that physical limitation of the paper to perfectly mimic the texture of corroded, water-damaged wood and rusted metal.
Wow.
The technique itself is in a direct dialogue with the harshness of the environment.
So the physical paper is actively acting like the weathered wood of the house.
Exactly.
Another element that really dictates the emotional tone of the piece is the scale.
Oh, the scale is incredible.
If you look closely at the human figures, you know, those kids on the roof, they're incredibly tiny.
Yeah, they are. And the proportions there are telling a story of institutional distance.
I mean, they are completely dwarfed by the structure of their own house. And they're practically swallowed by the massive sky that dominates the composition.
Yeah.
The sky takes up at least half the painting. And it isn't just a pretty atmospheric backdrop either.
No, because when you have a sky that large pressing down on figures that small, it visually communicates this immense isolation. It shows the sheer fragility of the human body out there on the lagoon. It basically acts as a visual reminder of just how far away this community is from the centers of power.
You mean like the governments and municipal planners who could actually provide them with basic infrastructure?
Exactly. The scale itself is a form of abandonment.
It's heavy. But even with all that heaviness, you know, the corroded textures, the crushing scale of the sky, the painting manages to hold on to a spark of life.
It does.
And I think the color palette does something wonderfully rebellious here.
Oh, the control of color here is absolute masterclass level.
Yeah.
So overall, the palette is austere and melancholic.
Right.
You are looking at washed out grays, deep shadowy blues, faded ochres.
It reflects a world that has just been relentlessly beaten down by sun and salt water.
Mm.
The environment feels totally drained.
Right. But then jumping out of that washed-out background, you get these highly saturated, vibrant pops of color.
Yes.
What's fascinating here is how those vibrant colors are exclusively reserved for the elements of human life.
Like the children's clothes and the laundry hanging out to dry on the line, and of course, the kites soaring up into that massive, oppressive sky.
Exactly. Those moments of high saturation basically act as visual buoys.
I love that. Visual buoys.
Yeah, they refuse to sink into the gray. They represent this human vitality that is actively rebelling against the precariousness of their surroundings. The community refuses to let the environment wash out their joy, and the color palette reflects that perfectly.
But balancing that sense of intense fragility with unyielding human resilience, that requires a profound confidence from the artist,
It really does.
which is what makes the behind-the-scenes reality of this painting so fascinating to me. Here's where it gets really interesting, because we actually have access to Jairo Duke's private notes.
Yeah, his own self-critique of the finished piece.
And it is filled with intense vulnerability. I mean, it's pretty rare to see an artist of this caliber openly dissect what they perceive as the flaws in a piece that ends up in an international gallery.
It's incredible to read. He was highly critical of his own composition.
Yeah, he placed the stilt house centrally, facing the viewer directly. And his notes reveal this deep anxiety that this frontal placement was just too static.
Right. He actually debated whether he should have used a risky diagonal frame instead to better convey the physical instability of the structure.
He thought a tilted angle might make the viewer physically feel how close the house is to falling into the water, like to really emphasize the danger of the palafito.
And his critiques didn't stop there. They extended to the execution of the figures in the atmosphere, too.
Right.
He worried the kids on the roof lacked what he called gestural punch. He felt they were too schematic.
He even second-guessed the water and the shadows. He feared they lacked vibration because he was so hesitant to oversaturate the image and lose the overall melancholic tone.
It's a lot of self-doubt.
It is, and I find his doubt deeply relatable. But looking at the final physical work, I frankly think he was entirely wrong to doubt his choices.
I strongly agree with you. If we evaluate the tension between his self-doubt and the final image, that very frontality that he worried was too static, that is actually the painting's greatest strength.
Right.
It gives the house a monumental legacy.
Because if he had painted it on a sharp diagonal, it might have looked like it was about to tip over in the next storm.
Exactly. It would frame the house, and by extension, the community, as a victim about to collapse.
Oh, that's a great point.
By placing it dead center, face on, it doesn't look fragile at all. It looks like an immovable monument to human resistance.
Yeah, it carries the visual weight of like a courthouse or a cathedral.
It does. It looks like it has been standing there defying the water for 100 years and will be there for 100 more. The stillness isn't static, it's defiant.
That gap between what the artist feared he created and the monumental reality of the final piece is profound. I really think his self-doubt just reflects his deep empathy and respect for the subject matter.
I completely agree.
He felt the overwhelming pressure of trying to distill the immense complexity of an entire amphibious community onto a piece of paper that is only 15 by 11 inches.
Yeah, the reality of the Cienaga Grande is simply too big for the paper.
It is.
And that gap, you know, between the 15 by 11-inch paper and the massive reality of the lagoon, that is the exact same gap Duke is pointing out with the title of the piece, Sin Internet.
Okay, so what does this all mean? This is where we decode the whole mission of our deep dive today.
Let's do it.
If we look at this painting, the stagnant water, the precarious stilt house, the kids seeking refuge on a zinc roof, and we know it has absolutely nothing to do with digital routers or fiber optic cables, what is the real disconnection the title is pointing at?
The title is an ironic gateway.
Okay.
It basically uses a modern first-world inconvenience to trick the viewer into confronting structural state abandonment.
Wow.
The painting implies massive, life-threatening infrastructure gaps without ever needing to paint a literal protest sign or a political slogan.
You just have to look the water beneath the house.
Exactly.
If you really read between the lines, the environment tells you everything you need to know about the gap between this community and the centers of urban development we talked about earlier.
Consider the implications of living suspended over that water.
Right. Because if the house is built over a stagnant lagoon, you immediately have to deduce the reality of terrible sanitation.
I mean, where does the waste go?
Exactly. And you deduce the intermittent or totally non-existent electricity. You think about the lack of nearby medical care, the absolute daily struggle it must be just to secure clean drinking water and fresh food when you don't even have a physical road leading to your front door.
And that is the true triumph of this watercolor. It manages to hold two impossible realities at the exact same time.
Yeah.
It captures the visual lightness and the innocent joy of children playing with a kite suspended high in the air. And simultaneously, in the very same frame, it holds the crushing, inescapable social weight of their daily reality.
It is an incredible amount of narrative to pull from a small sheet of textured paper.
It really is.
We started this deep dive expecting a commentary on digital anxiety or social media addiction.
Right.
But instead, we were transported from a gallery in Berlin to the profound realities of the Cienega Grande. We had to completely redefine what a city actually is, recognizing that urban spaces can be forged out of wood, custom, and pure survival.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, it forces a mirror up to our own lives.
Definitely.
Think about how you feel in a modern concrete city. We frequently claim to feel isolated.
Oh, all the time.
We experience genuine panic when our Wi-Fi drops for an hour, feeling entirely cut off from the world. Meanwhile, we entirely ignore the permanent, structural, life-threatening disconnections of marginalized communities that exist right outside our traditional maps of development.
It certainly puts a spinning wheel of doom on a laptop into stark perspective.
It does.
But it also leaves us with a deeply complex question about the future of development. And I want to leave you, our listener, with this thought to mull over as you go about your day.
It is sort of the ultimate paradox of urban planning.
Exactly. When modern urban planning finally reaches places like these amphibious settlements, when governments eventually bridge these massive infrastructure gaps by pouring concrete, laying down asphalt, and installing standard utilities, do we risk destroying that incredible organized survival?
It's a tough question.
Do we inadvertently dismantle the tight-knit social connectivity that force those kids to share a zinc roof as a public plaza in the first place?
Right. What might be lost when a community no longer has to fight the water just to exist?
It really challenges us to figure out how to provide necessary infrastructure without erasing the cultural resilience that built the community in the first place. Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We hope it gave you a new lens through which to view art, the definition of a city, and maybe even your own neighborhood. Keep your curiosity alive, and the next time you see that red light blinking on your router, take a moment to think about the zinc roofs of the Cienega Grande. Catch you next time.